Greetings and welcome to the Cathartic Yardstick with your hosts, Ray and Mark. In this episode, your intrepid hosts sit down with my brother Mike and discuss the 1950s and 1960s doctrine of nuclear mutually assured destruction, as well as Mike's recollections of the Cuban Missile Crisis. In the 1960s, the phrase nuking the Chinese had nothing to do with putting your takeout in the microwave. Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the War Room. Join us as the Cathartic Yardstick heads back to take a look at the swinging 60s, duck and cover style.
All right, we are back in the Cathartic Yardstick podcast. This is the second half of the session with Mark and Mike. All right, we should probably move on to the next topic.
Okay, all right. Well, seeing as we spent time talking about 60s culture and 60s music, there's another aspect of living in the 50s and 60s, charming little topic, called living under the Cold War doctrines of mutually assured destruction and limited nuclear war. And that's another claim to fame that Mike's got the battle streamer for.
You know, I'm beginning to think you guys just want me here because I'm the oldest guy you know.
Tell me of the Crimean War. Speak to me of tales of yore.
If you start talking about the Civil War, I'm really going to get pissed off. I just want you to know that. You know.
So no kidding. There was Grant, right?
I was too young. I was only 35.
Oh, okay. All right. So just to set the stage here.
Battle of Hastings.
1066. Why do we know that? I mean, there's probably some critical information, like when to activate your airbags or something. We've jettisoned that.
Don't be
that.
Talking about my airbag, okay? You promised me you wouldn't discuss
that. Battle of Hastings, 1066.
My airbag.
Oh, okay. So after World War II, the world was basically left with two superpowers, the United States and the Soviet Union, with profound economic and political differences. It was a struggle between communism and capitalism. It was a struggle of ideas and for influence and for territory with strategic importance. So the Cold War was really a state of geopolitical tension between the Soviet Union and its satellite states, the Eastern Bloc, and the U.S. with its allies, the Western Bloc and NATO. U.S. foreign policy featured a central principle of containment of Soviet expansionism in strategically vital regions. So Cold War, being the term for no direct large-scale fighting, but each side supported regional wars known as proxy wars. Both nations were armed with enough nuclear missiles to destroy the other, and that created somewhat of a stalemate, a standoff. It was the check against attack was the realization that you would be destroyed in return. It was really a policy of mutually assured destruction, or MAD. And to make matters more scary, there was also a doctrine that evolved of tactical or limited nuclear war. Germany, after the end of World War II, was stripped of its defensive capabilities. So in exchange, it relied on NATO for defense to keep the Soviets out. In the 50s, the Eisenhower era, Russia had the advantage in terms of size and armaments. And plus, one of the central tenets of a nuclear deterrence is to convince your adversaries that you're willing to actually use your arsenal. So the Soviets began to test smaller yield nukes in artillery shells, tactical nukes, with troops actually going through the detonation area shortly afterwards. The U.S. followed suit with similar tests. So you'll see footage of tests in Nevada with troops in foxholes, you know, watching the big mushroom cloud go up. The Soviet constructs became one of war starting with a large-scale nuclear exchange and then fought with more nukes on local battlefields, smaller nuclear exchanges. The tactical nuclear deterrent was seen as a way for NATO to be able to defend Germany without having to arm it, and also without having to maintain an army as large as the Soviet Union's. And so obviously this caused a widespread concern in the 50s and early 60s, triggered the building of backyard bomb shelters, debates about how survival nuclear war was. So with that backdrop, Mike.
I'm depressed.
I'm depressed. How could you be depressed? It's such a happy time. It's science. What do you remember about the era of duck and cover and bomb shelters, air raid sirens, that kind of thing?
Wow. Well, yeah, I mean, I was in elementary school. My going back to my earliest memories there, you know. So this was, let's see, throughout the 50s. Yeah, I remember, I won't say how frequent, I don't recall that, but I know it was simply something you did, like lunch, where you would have an air raid drill, which would scare the crap out of me. But I, had, you know, I didn't have a frame of reference, you know. And then we would all, the lights would go off, and we would march down to the basement, and it would be civil defense canisters there, and we would just hunker down until the all clear was given. And then we'd go back. And whenever I would hear sirens outside, you know, of course they'd be fire sirens, you know, but I didn't know. I mean, I would think of the same thing. Am I supposed to run and hide or drive my bike into a ditch and cover my head or something? Which was really incredible, as though this offered protection of some kind, you know. It's just, it was an odd time, you know. Yeah, I remember it very well. And it didn't play into my school phobia very well, I'll tell you, you know. I mean, it didn't help matters. Yeah.
Getting roasted away from the rest of your family.
No, I wanted to get roasted. Getting roasted is one thing. Having your family roasted and you not being roasted, that's something else, you know. But I think it just plays into that stuff. It was a mad time. It
yeah,
was crazy.
We didn't have those kind of things in school, but we still had the air raid siren in our town. We didn't have a volunteer fire department. We just had we had a paid fire department. Mm-hmm. So every Saturday at noon, they'd test the air raid sirens. So every Saturday, we're sitting there watching cartoons, and this air raid sirens would go off, and you'd always wonder, is this real or is this just a test? Or
yeah,
what would happen if they actually launched an attack, you know, mm-hmm. right when they're testing?
As a matter of fact, nobody's ever told me this, but it's always been my supposition, is the tests you have of the emergency broadcast system, I remember those with the assumption that that was in case of nuclear attack. It wasn't so much for storms.
Here's a confession, you know, for you. When I hear those emergency broadcasting, you'll get this pitched whistle. I tell you, I get that feeling in the pit of my stomach. That's exactly what, of course, do I think it's a nuclear attack? No. But first comes the feeling. And then,
and it's not a tornado you're thinking of.
No. And then the thought kicks in. But the feeling, it's a visceral reaction I have to it, yeah.
I don't think they were used for weather or other things when we were younger. It was pretty much just for civil defense.
That's what I remember.
Yeah. Yeah.
I remember doing duck and cover drills at St. Joseph's School in Scotia. And as a matter of fact, it was first grade. I remember Monday by the Mamas and Papas was on the charts.
Well, Mark, that amazes me. I didn't think they still had them.
Well, they were nuns, so.
They were still pissed about that Immaculate Conception thing.
Probably. Probably.
No, I thought that was over, you know, by then. I thought it was a 50s,
nope.
60 thing. Of course, what am I talking about? The Cuban Missile Crisis, that was after that. So, yeah,
that's
you're right.
Right,
yeah.
Which is a topic I'm steaming towards. But it was interesting. I remember doing a duck and cover drill as a first grader. And I'm sitting there under my desk staring at all this plate glass window right in front of me. And I remember thinking to myself, if these bombs are as big as what it looks like on television, I don't get how this is going to help. But I guess some scientist has figured out that a desk will protect you from the fallout,
desk,
I guess.
Yeah. It's funny.
It just gives you something to do.
Maybe that's what it was.
In your last moments. Yeah. Was it the sort of thing that adults talked about in front of the children or that you saw on television? I mean, what would kids have perceived about the state of affairs with mutually assured destruction? Is it just something you picked up vicariously from snippets of television? Or
I mean, it was our favorite nightmare. I mean, I never came up in the house. The only discussion I ever had with that, with our father, was the Cuban Missile Crisis. Not until then. But throughout all the time before that, it never came up in the house. It just was a favorite.
It was present, I mean, because of the drills.
Always
and such,
right? Present, definitely. I mean, I have to say, I know I'm a kidder, but I'm not kidding. I mean, I see, given who I was at the time, I was kind of traumatized, you know, by that chronic you know, reality. Now you're supposed to go, oh, poor Michael Young.
Mike. Light the aromatherapy candle, Ray. Yeah. Lexi crisis.
Well, another principle.
Play then, ocean sounds. Yeah. Quick.
Another thing that was part of that whole national defense was first strike capability. And that kind of bounced back and forth between us and the Russians, and depending on, you know, the arms race. And,
I guess,
you know, based on the belief that, you know, whoever had the first strike capability could, you know, launch preemptive strike and take out the other before they were able to retaliate.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of brings us to some fun adventures in the fall of 1962. You know, for those of you who weren't around, the Cuban Missile Crisis was basically a 13-day confrontation between the United States and the Soviet Union. I guess actually between October 16th and 28th of 1962. The U.S. had supported democratic leaders in Cuba up until the late 50s. In 59, there was a communist revolution, and Fidel Castro took over as dictator in Cuba. He started seizing private land, so there's always Cuban exiles fleeing to the United States. So now we have a Soviet satellite state 90 miles off the Florida coast. JFK comes into office in January of 61 as this young, brand new president, about 44 years old, with not a great deal of foreign policy experience.
Mm-hmm.
Right away, as he's coming in the door, he's handed this plan that was formulated under the Eisenhower administration, CIA, to have Cuban exiles essentially invade Cuba and try to topple Fidel Castro. And that was in mid-April 1961. It was supposed to look like the Cubans were taking back their own country from a dictator, and it was supposed to actually have a lot of U.S. air and naval support. JFK was a skeptic, and as soon as it started, it was transparent and obvious that the U.S. was behind it all. So JFK decided not to provide more air support and make it more obvious. So the CIA ended up with about half the support they said was needed to pull the operation off. And the invaders surrendered after 3 days, and it was a fiasco.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the failed Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba in 1961. Now, simultaneously, as a check to the Soviet Union in Europe, the U.S. placed American ballistic missiles in Italy and Turkey. The combination of both these events, coupled with Fidel Castro's request for assistance to protect Cuba against future American invasions, prompted the Soviet Union to place nuclear missiles in Cuba, 90 miles off the U.S. mainland. Our aerial surveillance picked up the missile bases being built and the missiles being shipped. There wasn't a whole lot of back-channel diplomacy. This was brinksmanship playing out on the international stage and all over the media. The U.S. announced that it would not permit offensive weapons to be delivered to Cuba. The U.S. established a naval blockade of the island on October 22nd. It was a nightly news event. And the confrontation, the Cuban Missile Crisis, is actually considered to be the closest that the Cold War ever came to escalating into a full-scale war.
Mm-hmm.
So my question was, what's your first recollection of hearing about this Cuban Missile Crisis thing?
My first recollection. Oh my God! Well, okay. What a story.
What was the buzz?
Well, first of all, though, I mean, it wasn't. You know, the thing that people, not enough people know, and McNamara wrote about it extensively. A great book called In Retrospect, where he talks about, you know, Vietnam and everything, but he talks about those days and how we really were close, and it was nothing but, as he says, his word, luck. That it didn't happen, but that's a whole other conversation. My recollection, well, as I mentioned in the other podcast, talking about the Immaculate Conception, about having been in the seminary at 14, that's where I was in November, and just so phobic. I'd never been away from home before, and I just was a neurotic. I know this is going to come as a surprise to you guys, but I was pretty neurotic. No, I was a wreck. I was a wreck there. And then now I find out that I'm never going to see home again because the bomb is obviously going to get dropped, you know, right on our house. But it was a reaction similar to all children, I think, would have But in my case, it was terrifying, absolutely terrifying. That's my recollection of it. And could not be consoled. You know, it was bad.
Probably the Cuban Missile Crisis was the last big national news story like that that totally escaped me. I mean, I knew about duck and cover, I knew about nukes, but that particular political standoff just blended into everything else. How about you, Ray? I mean, do you have any recollections
of
it?
I have no recollection of that whatsoever, yeah.
So anyways, after a long period of tense negotiations, there was an agreement reached between JFK and Khrushchev. Publicly, the Soviets would dismantle their offensive weapons in Cuba in exchange for a U.S. public declaration and agreement to avoid invading Cuba again. Now, secretly, the U.S. agreed that it would dismantle the missiles it had deployed in Turkey. And then the Washington-Moscow hotline was established as a result to try to head off these things in the future because it was pretty darn close. Now, interestingly, I think that the Cuban Missile Crisis is a perfect illustration of a historical event that's viewed a bit differently between the time it happened and after the passage of a few decades. At the time it first happened, and for about 25 years afterwards, it was really portrayed as JFK's finest hour. And that was it was portrayed in official accounts, books by JFK aides, you know, Ted Sorensen, his speechwriter, Arthur Schlesinger Jr., special assistant. You know, the message was JFK had been skillful, tough, and resolute, and showed, you know, through shrewd intelligence and careful planning, he avoided war while forcing Khrushchev to back down. It really wasn't until the 80s and later that they started declassifying National Security Council minutes and documents, and it showed that JFK had actually made a deal with the Soviets under which the U.S. would yield to the Soviet demand for removal of U.S. missiles from Turkey. One term of the deal, however...
They couldn't talk about it, right?
Well, they couldn't talk about it, right? Mm-hmm. And apparently, I've read that only half of Kennedy's top U.S. advisors even knew of that part of the agreement. The minutes also revealed that JFK was receiving a lot of counsel to do preemptive strike in Cuba to take out the Soviet missiles. You had, on the other side, you had UN Ambassador Adlai Stevenson counseling JFK that world opinion is going to equate U.S. missiles in Turkey with the being the exact same as Cuban or missiles in Cuba pointed at the U.S. So Stevenson counseled that the U.S. needed to give something in order to get a concession, and that something we gave away needs to be with the withdrawal of missiles in Turkey, as well as giving up Guantanamo Bay naval base that we had since before the revolution. And apparently Stevenson faced a pretty serious backlash from the NSC, as it was thought that that would be a horrible political embarrassment for JFK to immediately offer concessions. The minutes show that JFK pulled Schlesinger aside and said that concessions have to come at the end of negotiation, not the beginning. Do the blockade first. It won't make the Soviets pull back by itself, but it will get their attention and their concern. And then the U.S. can talk about a deal. He didn't want to appear weak. Apparently there had already been some big summit between he and Khrushchev before, where Khrushchev really made him look like a rookie. That was the perception. Yeah. It was one of his first outings.
Right.
He was very, very sensitive. The other thing I ran into just reading about the Cuban Missile Crisis, how hard it is when you're on the razor's edge, the fingers on the trigger, and you're leading an entire nation, and it has to act in unison. You can't do it. There's too many moving parts to the federal government to have it all move in unison. So there were a whole bunch of unusually dangerous errors that were happening right in the middle of the crisis. Things like a high-level U.S. military alert. We went to DEFCON 2, and that's one step below nuclear war is imminent. DEFCON 1 is nuclear war is imminent. And we were at DEFCON 2. But we gave it on an open communication system, which easily could have led the Soviet Union to think this was an indication of a first U.S. strike. There was a pre-scheduled test launch of a U.S. ICBM, intercontinental ballistic missile, in California. And they went ahead with the test. and talk about something that could have been perceived as a first strike.
Wow.
There was also a Soviet submarine captain in the Caribbean, apparently coming very close to using a nuclear torpedo on U.S. ships and Khrushchev had all he could do to unplug that. Mm. And also in the middle of all this, there was a U.S. U-2 reconnaissance plane that strayed into Soviet airspace. And the response was, because you couldn't get on the radio and say, hey, knucklehead, get out of Soviet airspace. That would have caused an incident. What they did was they sent up aircraft that were in the area to escort the plane back on the right side. But the plane that went into escort were nuclear armed.
Oh, wow.
And so it's just amazing that something didn't trigger an escalation. Mm. It's also amazing that a young president whose presidency started with the failed Bay of Pigs invasion had such a steady hand in negotiations. Reportedly, at one point, RFK asked JFK what the odds were of this going into an actual nuclear exchange, and JFK responded, 30% to 50%.
Yeah. Well, you know, what's interesting, I don't want to interrupt you there, Mark. Were you going to?
No, I'm done.
Yeah, one of the things McNamara talks about, and I haven't read it in a long time, and I don't think it's on the movie, documentary, I can't remember the name of it, but it's in the book in retrospect, where he talks about how the belief up until relatively recent times, like you say, Mark, declassifying documents, was that the missiles were not assembled, that we just saw the makings of them and the U-2 flights, you know, picked it up, but they picked it up and that's what, but in point of fact, they were constructed. There were many constructed when McNamara was with Castro at a DC event. He asked him, he said, you know, you had those things there. Would you have, if Cuba was attacked, even if it wasn't nuclear, would you have used them? And he said, yes. He said, yes, I would have. And McNamara says, my God, you would have brought the temple down. This is the expression he used. You bring the temple down on your head? And Fidel Castro says, yes, I was going to. So that would have, faulty intelligence, we would have started, you know, the Third World War, absolutely. But it was luck, as McNamara said, that the reason why nuclear war did not happen, despite the accumulated experience in the room, you know, military whizzes of the likes of Curtis LeMay and the far right and those who were opposed to it, the voice, the current in the room was, we have to strike. And it was Kennedy and Bobby who basically, you know, said, not yet. We can always do that. And just waited it out. So it's amazing. According to McNamara, it was luck. He kept using that word, luck. That's all it was, luck. And Mark, with things that you say, underscore that even more.
Yeah, and it really underscores to me that leaders have tremendous power, but they're still human beings, and they have all the flaws that human beings have, and fragmentary information and instinct or lack thereof, right, and luck or lack thereof. So it really sets the stage for a future podcast when we can talk about something like Vietnam. Mm-hmm. But wow, I mean, it was really an amazing time. So my last couple of questions on this topic, it really kind of ties things up, was, you know, so a year later, basically, Kennedy is assassinated. So what's your recollection of the Kennedy assassination? What did you hear about it? What do you remember of it?
Oh my God. No, that was huge, because it was foreign to me, totally. You know, a president being assassinated just seemed something that happened to Abraham Lincoln, you know, and it doesn't happen anymore. And not to Kennedy, this picture of youth and vitality, and it just was utterly unthinkable. And then it was the first time that an event like that happened, and all of TV networks just basically shut down their programs. And it was a period of trauma, national trauma and mourning and a funeral played out in real time. I don't think that ever happened before. I mean, certainly not of that magnitude, but at all.
And then Lee Harvey Oswald getting shot on top of
it. I saw it happen. I was watching TV. We're all glued to the TV. There was no school. We're glued to the TV. And then I'm going to see what Lee Harvey Oswald looks like. And here he comes. Bang. I mean, what the hell? What is going on here? It just was a strange...
And then Jack Ruby mysteriously dies.
I don't know. It just was so bizarre. But I was very powerfully affected. I was standing outside the cafeteria at Scotia High School in 10th grade. And I still remember the woman, a young 10th grader who came up to me and said, President Kennedy's been shot. You know, the air was sucked right out of the room. I remember. Yeah, amazing.
I can remember. It's really my awakening to the world kind of intruding on my childhood. But I can remember being out in the dining room, and I have a memory of Mom having the TV out in the dining room for a period of time. It was normally in the living room. Mm-hmm. But we had a TV in the dining room, is at least the way I remember it. And I was out there playing. She was busy in the kitchen working. And I remember it came in the form of three bulletins. The first one was that shots were fired in the motorcade. There was a soap opera on, I remember. And then the second one was that the president had been hit. And the last one was that he was dead.
It was unimaginable. You know, Robert Caro is a five-volume series on LBJ, writes about, it's such a compelling account of how it affected what that flight was like on the way back and what LBJ did and standing in the ER and the ride over. And it's an amazing account of how, it was traumatic for us and for the country. But for these guys, I mean, people were just stricken, his staff. His staff loved him, And so it was, in addition to being the obvious end of their careers, essentially, they thought, although LBJ did want them all to stay on and kept them on until they quit, that they were broken people, sobbing, that the flight back must have been just surreal.
I remember reading an article, and this goes into the whole idea about how JFK and Johnson as vice president couldn't have been more different, cut from different cloth. And a lot of tension between them, and it was tension between their staffs as well. And I remember reading an article from one of the staffers talking about the flight out to Dallas, where you had all JFK's folks in the front of the plane, all Johnson's folks in the back of the plane, feeling kind of powerless, and how the tide turned. And suddenly on the way back, it was Johnson's folks in the front and the Kennedy folks in the back figuring out what the hell just happened.
But LBJ being the character, the odd person that he was, I mean, it's quite a story of his decision to become... to go on the ticket and be VP, which is everyone saying, what are you doing? And he had done the calculus of vice presidents or presidents who don't survive. So he was doing the math in 8 years. I mean, honestly, the stuff. But once he became the quintessential, dutiful, deferential VP and was treated like crap. But he didn't do anything to try to get himself out of it. I mean, he just was, and he, literally imploded. He became nothing. He became sullen and pouty and just this pitiful figure. And then that event, and the stories abound of witnesses who said it's like he was filled up with air again, but he became perfect. How he handled it, how he handled other people, how he handled himself on the flight, his staff, everything was done. He became the giant of the Senate again that he was. Yeah, fascinating story of personalities, huge personalities, of not typical people.
What about you, Ray? You remember hearing the news?
I didn't hear the news. I remember watching the funeral. I remember sitting on the couch next to my mother, who would have been like 4 years old, and she's just sitting on the couch crying, and we're just sitting there watching TV, and I didn't really completely understand what was going on. Mm. I just remember, the riderless horse and the caisson rolling down the street. And I knew it was a significant event, but I really didn't understand the whole gravity of the situation.
Mm. Yeah, John giving his salute, little kid. It's like, jeez.
I mean, amazing.
Incredible.
The blood-stained dress. I mean, amazing.
Yeah, incredibly intense. And then reading afterwards, when Jackie was offered to change, she said, no, right. I want them to see what they've done.
Right, right.
Wow. Incredible. So obviously Vietnam is probably too big a variable to be able to look into the crystal ball. But had JFK lived, how do you think his time in office would have been viewed by historians? Let's give him two full terms.
You mean what would he have done about Vietnam, or are you going around that?
Well, I'm including it. You know, what kind of president do you think he would have been had he been given two full terms? And then the corollary to that might be, how do you think Vietnam would have played out?
Based on the handling of the Cuban Missile Crisis, I think Kennedy probably would not have gone for the protracted war of attrition in Vietnam and would have tried to maybe make a more decisive victory there.
Would that have meant a quicker withdrawal or redoubling, throwing more troops in?
I think redoubling, maybe bombing Hanoi or something like that.
Yeah, and your first question, you know, what kind of president would he have been? He had no drag whatsoever in Congress. So that's what LBJ was for. And he had made such an enemy out of him. Not an enemy, just, you know, so derisive. I can't see it playing out. He may have, and you know, certainly LBJ wouldn't have wanted him to be all that successful under the circumstances. So I think it's a real unanswerable question. He was young. He had no influence in the Senate. He had a lot of cachet, you know, with the American public and Camelot and all that stuff. But when the rubber hits the road and you got to push a bill through, LBJ knew how to do that, but JFK was clueless, and his little brother Bobby, you know, who was a pit bull, but he hadn't come into his own yet. I can't imagine the presidency having been successful. I really don't. And about Vietnam, what's interesting is, you know, I think I'm with Ray that he didn't have LBJ's dog in the fight, you know, not being the first president to lose a war and having McNamara, you know, pull out on him because it's not winnable, and they knew that it was unwinnable. LBJ, you know, long before 68, they knew. That's what the Pentagon Papers are all about. It was unwinnable. So Kennedy, you know, would he have clung tenaciously that way? Probably not. But at the very same time, you know, he really was complicit in Diem's assassination, not complicit as in he wanted it to happen, but he looked the other way so that it could happen, saying that that was just a cataclysmic event and mistake, because then the hands of power were handed to these people who couldn't find their ass with both hands, you know, General Khan and Key and all the rest of these guys. They'd be in power, then it'd be out, and then Khan would come back in. It became a complete catastrophe.
Yeah, but I wonder if Kennedy would have had support for the war that Johnson lacked. Kennedy would have brought his constituency with him and had that support behind him.
Except that Johnson just jump-started it with Bay of Tonkin resolution. He just jump-started and he had all the power he wanted. He did, you know, he just ran the war. And then Congress would get on their high horse of moral indignation, or as I like to say, they never met a high horse of moral indignation they couldn't mount. And but they'd continue to vote appropriations for it because the public, you know, did not want to pull out of it. So he had all the power he can get, you know.
And Kennedy would have continued to have McNamara as SecDef.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And so the question is, I suppose, once you finally start getting the G2 that conventionally this thing is not going to play out well, that's really, how do you handle that?
Maybe that was
the big fork in the road.
I mean, LBJ was determined to just ram it through. He was not going to lose that war, but would JFK have lost the war? Would he have just submarined his presidency by pulling out, which is what would have happened? He would have saved I mean, most of the American deaths happened under Nixon, you know? but would he have sacrificed 20-some-odd thousand American lives and just pulled out and said, oops?
Would he have been a visionary in terms of statesmanship and come up with some kind of, you know, statement-like deal?
Well, that's what Johnson wanted to do, which it was Ho Chi Minh. he wanted his country reunited. There was no compromising with that guy. Mm-hmm. And that's something Americans never warmed up to, the fact of how this guy can be in the process of losing what amounted to 10% of the population of his country. That's the equivalent of 30 million Americans. I mean, think about it. And, you know, and the final words of the interviews with Pham Van Dong, the prime minister, and the general, Vo Nguyen Giap, the great general, said that, you know, you kill ten of us to year one, that's okay, because they kind of knew that Americans didn't care about the 10, they cared about the 1, and we got to watch them every night, the body count, every night. I mean, the war was, there's no way, and they knew we were going to lose it. They knew it was unwinnable as a war of attrition, because they were literally giving birth to more Vietnamese than, you know, doing the math, then we were capable of killing. And the national will was untouched. These Confucian thinking people, you know, who were just bombing the crap out of rural areas up north, rolling thunder. I mean, it was unwinnable, and they knew it. That's what the Pentagon Papers were.
Well, any other miscellaneous thoughts? That kind of ties up where I was going.
I was just getting warmed up.
I have
my notes here. I was going to read the Pentagon Papers. I have all the volumes here. Can I do that?
Well, let's rack six. Things up for hour three then.
Yeah. Thank you very much for taking the time. This is a blast.
Well, the thing really is, like I said, I'm the oldest guy you guys know. To me, it's not history. I was there, and you're taking advantage of me. I want you to know that I'm being used. I know I'm being used.
So for the next promotional clip for the Cathartic Yardstick, we'll have Mike reading a hostage script. You know.
Thank you for listening to the Cathartic Yardstick podcast. As we strolled down memory lane and fondly remembered the constant threat of nuclear annihilation, join us again.
Well, it was narcolepsy, and this is narcolepsy by proxy.
Ooh. That sounds strangely legal, doesn't it?
Oh my God.